What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. Dr. Wilkes wrote an incredible book called Code Red Fallujah. In it, he discusses being a young doctor embedded with the heavily weaponized 1st Marines Division as the Battle of Fallujah boils to a head. Sharing the harrowing entries from his field diary, Wilkes becomes among the first of Navy physicians to recount the intimate details of one of the most violent events of the entire Iraq War. In heart-pounding drama, he divulges his struggles to save wounded warriors amidst rockets landing close enough to knock him off his feet. Rarely have U.S. military physicians been so close to combat in a major conflict as they were in the chaotic, embattled streets of Fallujah. When Wilkes, fresh out of medical school, is suddenly thrust into this war zone, his skills, his faith, and his ability to endure are all put to the test. Code Red Fallujah is the wrenching, intimate memoir of a doctor who, when faced with unimaginable tragedy, ultimately experiences an intense and inspiring spiritual awakening. I spoke with him for about 45 minutes. It was a real pleasure, and I know you will enjoy this. And now I give you Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. Okay, I'm here with Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. Dr. Wilkes, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Josh. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure. I want to discuss, obviously, your brush with history, Dr. Wilkes. I want to discuss your experiences. I also want to discuss your book, Code Red Fallujah. But before we get into all that, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
You got it. And, you know, you said you want to talk about my brush with history. And it strikes me that, yep, it is history now. It obviously didn't feel like that 20 years ago, but the Iraq War and my experience in my book is becoming historically relevant in a lot of ways. So to answer your question, my name is Donnelly Wilkes. I'm from California, born in Southern California, but grew up in Northern California, Placerville or El Dorado County, which is in the foothills of Sacramento and the Sierra Nevadas. Pretty typical childhood, but small town area, which I liked. Played sports, a lot of outdoor stuff, hunting, water skiing, backpacking, etc. My dad coached us in t-ball and baseball all the way into high school. I was a decent student and became, I would say, a good to very good student in high school. I think partially because I was working with my father on his job sites from the time I can remember. He was a contractor and, you know, so a lot of manual labor, which of course taught me a lot of good values. But I decided I wanted to use my body and my brain for something else than manual labor. So I hit the books and did well in school and set my sights on medicine pretty early. In fact, my dad and I had a conversation one day late in high school talking about what I'm going to do with my life. And I had mentioned, oh, maybe physical therapy or the healthcare field or maybe an attorney. And he said, you know, well, why don't you just be a doctor? And my initial reply is, well, Dad, that's a lot of school and really hard. And, you know, he kind of looked at me like, so what? I know you can do it type thing. And so him instilling that confidence piqued my interest and I set my sights on medicine and never looked back.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that was my childhood. And then I can give you a little bit of post-high school, if you'd like, and what led me to medicine in the military.
Yes, please do. The floor is yours.
Okay. So right after high school, I applied to colleges, mostly in California, ended up at University of California, Irvine, because they had a good pre-med program. And I spent 2 years in junior college in Sacramento, did well, got into UC Irvine, and also continued to do well enough to apply to medical school. With that said, uphill battle, thousands of applicants for just, you know, 100, 150 spots at most schools in the United States. I almost ended up at Trinity College in Ireland, because I was accepted there, but turned it down. I just wasn't ready to jump outside the U.S. yet. So I ended up at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. And that turned out to be a great choice. It was scary for at least a year because New Orleans is wild and I didn't have any family there and I felt like a fish out of water. But after a year, it really became a second home. And I ended up living in New Orleans for almost 7 years and just loved my time there, loved the culture, the lifestyle. The practice and art of medicine has deep roots there. And in fact, the book opens in New Orleans with a chapter devoted to talking a little bit about the city and my time there. So that was great training. And that's kind of where the Navy got a hold of me. One of the recruiters kind of contacted me and told me about the Navy scholarship. And basically, the gist of it is, if you're accepted, you apply for, and if you're accepted into the Navy scholarship program, they'll pay for medical school. And then in turn, when you graduate, you are commissioned immediately as a lieutenant in the United States Navy, and you owe 7 years of service.
Excellent. Excellent. That actually funnels beautifully into my next question there, Dr. Wilkes. So perhaps I'll phrase it this way. Where were you on 9/11 and how did it impact your life?
Great question. And it was a pivotal point, as it was for so many. For me, I was a fourth year in medical school. I was entering the hospital, doing my morning rounds, saw a group of people gather around a television set, which is usually a pit stop for coffee and conversation. But on this day, everybody looked especially interested and even alarmed. I look at the TV and there's the Twin Towers burning. So on that day, you know, I will never forget that I was commissioned or set to enter the Navy upon graduation. And I had this feeling that my life would be forever changed. I didn't know how, but I knew that I was going to be in the military for 7 years and that my trajectory would be altered forever. When I say that, for military medical students, you know, typically the path is you go to residency at a military training institution, and then you deploy maybe to a base anywhere around the world in one of the United States military installations in Europe, in Japan, in the Pacific, you name it, around the world. And you're there for a year or two, or you stay stateside and you're at a base or on a ship stationed out of San Diego or something like that. But in peacetime, it's a pretty calm, easy duty, so to speak. And that's your commitment. In wartime, all of that changes and the needs of the military come into play. And so I knew that that was in store for me. And in short order, really short order, it was. And I'll go into that in a minute, because that was one of the main differences in my story as a military doctor compared to peacetime.
Sure. Excellent. So yeah, your military experience, somewhat unique for a doctor, to put it mildly. You were deployed into what's called a battalion aid station. For our audience, and for me, for that matter, what is a battalion aid station? Why do you think you were sent there?
Yeah, so my experience was unique. And to set that up a little bit, as I was saying, you know, there's a lot of military physicians. Not many end up in combat zones because we're not always in conflicts that require big assaults, big battles, et cetera. So, you know, prior to the Iraq War, probably it would go back to Vietnam, to where there was military physicians in close proximity to major battles. So we'll just put it that way. Going back to your question about a battalion aid station, in a battalion, for me, it was the Marine Corps. A battalion is about 900 to 1,000 men, and each battalion has 1 to 2 physicians. We had 2. When they are deployed and go off to a war zone, typically they plus it up to 2 physicians, 2 docs. And so when the Marines mobilize and they start going out on missions from their forward operating base, you can set up aid stations. You have 1 at the forward operating base. It's a stationary aid station. And then if you push into a battle zone, like my Marines did into Fallujah, you set up a field battalion aid station. For us, it was underneath a freeway overpass. And it was simply a stationary position with a little bit of protection, some Marines on post around us because we're exposed in an open field underneath this freeway. So some Marines to protect us. And then we just set up cans. When I say cans, metal containers full of medical supplies, everything from medications to bandages to quick clot to make wounds clot faster to surgical airway kits. So some field trauma supplies and surgical supplies and aid supplies to treat combat injuries. That's what an aid station is. And it's all carried within these mobile units that the Marines are able to transport by Humvee and trucks into the field and set up that stationary position. So that's where I was during the Battle of Fallujah.
Extraordinary. Oh, thank you, Dr. Wilkes. In the book, you go into some detail about the convoy. This will be, if I wrote down correctly, March 18th, 2004.
That's right.
Yes, sir. Just in plain words, what was the convoy?
The convoy was also a wild experience for me. And even, you know, for the Marines, they don't necessarily convoy to their destination more than they have to. To answer your question, convoy is a train of vehicles for our battalion, about 50 to 75 vehicles, loaded up with everything they need to survive and operate and conduct military operations. We flew into Kuwait. That's where we assembled as a battalion. And then we trained for about a week in a convoy formation so that you can transport the entire battalion in those vehicles up into Iraq to our forward base. So we left Kuwait in that convoy, 50 to 75 vehicles long, and we traveled for 3 days up into the heart of Iraq. The night that I'll never forget is when I woke up and we're moving along like a snake through the night, and I look out on the horizon, it's pitch black, and all I can see are the oil rigs that Saddam had lit on fire that we had all seen on TV, and I had seen on TV just a few weeks ago, and now I'm traveling right towards them, and it really, you know, kind of set this deep-seated feeling in my gut that I'm heading towards this dark place in the world where a lot of violence was happening, and it wasn't on TV anymore. It was for real. So we made it after 3 days by convoy into Fallujah, right outside the heart of the city, and that's where our forward base was. It was a our base was a little compound, cinder block walls, about a half mile in circumference, and it was an old Saddam training camp, basically, that we had taken over and made our forward operating base.
Understood. And yeah, perhaps just to maybe throw a little bit of texture to that, I have a quote that I pulled from the book, if I may.
Sure.
So that's this is going to be chapter three. Begin quote. We traveled north from Kuwait for 3 days across the ash and scabland, stopping only for gas and sleep. Signs of life are rare. No rivers or streams in sight. Only miles of lifeless, tortured earth. The ground is dry and broken. The slightest breath of wind whisks dirt into the air. End quote. Just to give people a sense of the wilderness, so to speak.
Yeah, I do love that quote, because when I wrote it, and as I did with much of the book, I would just sometimes close my eyes and meditate and put myself back in that place, in that space, and picture the sights and the sounds. And what always would come back to me is some of those words I used that lend to the wasteland, the empty feeling, almost apocalyptic fallout type landscape, really devoid of life, devoid of feeling in some cases, very lonely in some in some cases. But that's where your reliance on those men. In my case, it was all men because our battalion was all male. But those people next to you, those guys next to you to help get you through what can be a really lonely environment. And that's the fog of war that really, I'm kind of letting my thoughts spiral here. But
no problem.
What really hit me was that war hasn't changed much over the decades or maybe even a century. The sights, the sounds, the feelings, of course, I'm just going back into historical context and what I've seen on TV and in conversation. But from the days of World War I to now, when it comes to ground combat and being in that environment, bullets and band-aids and just general survival and techniques and procedures, not a lot's changed. Bullets are still bullets. Mortars are mortars. We've got some advanced weaponry and even some advanced medical capabilities, but the real bare minimum essence of war hasn't changed much. The feeling of it didn't change much.
Yeah.
Over time.
Yeah, understood.
And I verified that with men and women who have been in the military much longer than me.
I've spoken with both of my brothers, and they both have affirmed the same thing. I have a brother in the Marines and a brother in the Army. So
okay. Yep.
So just to press on then, so
yes.
Yes, sir. So you arrive at Camp Mercury. I'd love for you to describe for our audience the setting there. What did it look like to you?
Yeah, so Camp Mercury, as I was saying, former Saddam terrorist training camp, cinder block walls in a square, half mile circumference, moon dust and gravel. was the landscape over most of it. A few hardened structures, old buildings, some blocks, some made out of wood. And then in addition to that, the Marines would set up tents. We would have one block wall building that was our command operations center that we would conduct meetings out of, operational planning out of, communications, four guard posts on each corner to provide overwatch for the security of the camp. Marines posted at all openings, of which there was one main guard gate where vehicles would go in and out of, conducting operations out into the Al-Anbar province, into the cities surrounding the base, which included places like Fallujah and Ramadi. Those were the hot spots for much of the Iraq war. And then tents where the men would sleep. We had a little aid station that we set up. We had a little chow hall. We had a little chapel that was really just the chow hall turned into a chapel when people weren't eating there. And that was it. That was life, you know, for 7 months. And just to give your listeners a little bit of context on a timeline here, the Iraq war began March 20, 2003. That was when the U.S., joined by the U.K., Australia, Poland, launched their shock and awe campaign. Iraqi forces were quickly overwhelmed by that coalition of forces. Following the collapse of, you know, the Ba'ath Party infrastructure in early 2003, local residents of Fallujah elected a town council. Over the next 6 to 12 months, general civil unrest, protests, and insurgent violence led to complete instability of Fallujah. So then in March of 2004, authority over the whole Al-Anbar province was transferred from the army, which had been the primary military occupational force, to 1st Marine Expeditionary Forces, MEF-1, under the command of Lieutenant General Conway. That's where myself and my battalion became involved. I was in 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and we fell under that 1st Marine Expeditionary Forces. Things weren't going well in the Al-Anbar province, and so the Marines were called in to take action. And that's when I knew, shortly out of residency, when I was plucked or pulled from residency and stashed within a Marine Corps battalion, that's when I knew things weren't going well and that we were going to head into battle in Fallujah. Most physicians, even in the military, go all the way through residency and then they practice medicine. In wartime, the military will pluck physicians out of residency and send them off for deployments. That's what happened to me. And that doesn't happen to any normal physician. They have to complete residency to practice medicine. The military, it's different. And that's why it was very unique for me, because any doctor will tell you, if you haven't finished residency, you still feel like a baby doc. But in the military, all that goes out the window. And as they needed to, you know, they needed more docs in combat. And so that's what happened to me. They put me through extra training in field trauma and combat medicine in places like Texas, in places like Newport, Rhode Island, to give you the skills you needed to become an expert in combat medicine. So I was very fortunate to have that. But once those bullets start flying and mortars are landing around you and the wounded Marines are coming to you, man, nothing can prepare you for that moment.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. And actually, you use the word mortar, so that slightly gives this question away a little bit. But so you described in the book as the first 3 days being fairly uneventful. So my question is going to be, what happened on the fourth day, Dr. Wilkes?
You got it. So this is my first exposure to indirect fire, is what we're going to call it. And that, you know, that refers to anything that's not a bullet from a weapon aimed at you directly. So this is rockets and mortars. We're out in the recreation tent, little tent in the back of our forward base. And we're playing ping pong, hanging out. Marines are playing Xbox on some hardwired television sets. And we hear a few just thuds in the distance, almost like thunder. But it piques your interest enough because that thud had this concussive force to it that just shook the ground a little bit. And then in the next moment, those thuds became booms that were rocking the earth like a mini earthquake. And then immediately after that, felt like they were landing on your head. So what these were mortars tracking closer to the base. And then sure enough, a couple hit really close to us. They don't have to be that close to rock your world. If they hit within 100 yards, you're going to feel like hell itself is coming down upon you. So we grab our weapons and we start scrambling for a hard structure because that's what we're taught to do. It's dark. We can't see anything. The mortars continue landing around us. they're close enough that they kind of rock you as you're running. And we're trying to get back to the battalion aid station because we're suspecting there could be some wounded Marines there. And it's just complete, you know, kind of chaos. Yet, you know, we know where we're doing and where we're supposed to go. I kind of joke in the book that I forgot to pick up my weapon, which is a 9mm pistol, which I never forgot again after that. But I said, hey, that can remain stationary for a minute. I'm getting to the aid station. And no, thankfully, nobody was hurt that night. None of the mortars had any direct hits. But that was my opening to what it felt like to understand that that mortar was meant to kill me and my men. And there's just nothing that can prepare you for what that feels like.
Absolutely. That's incredible. The book itself describes you as, begin quote, the first ever Navy physician to recount the sights and sounds of one of the most violent events of the entire Iraq war, end quote. I know we were talking a little bit before we went on air here, Dr. Wilkes. My job as the host of a podcast like Eyewitness History is to precisely to expose our listeners to the sights and sounds of those who, you know, have witnessed these historical events.
Right.
So from here, I basically just want to throw the floor over to you to take all the time you need, really, to take us through your Fallujah experience.
Yeah, I can do that. And, you know, just a little disclaimer, of course, I'm not saying I'm the first physician to ever experience this or be in harm's way or things like that. There's plenty of amazing people that have come before me. But in this particular event, the Battle of Fallujah, I was the first physician in a Marine Corps battalion this close to combat to describe it. And so that's all I was saying there. And I appreciate you throwing that out there.
Yes, sir.
There was a handful of us during this corridor from probably 2003 to 2005 Navy physicians who were positioned with Marine Corps battalions and had combat experiences. And so a shout out to the fellow Navy and Army and even Air Force military men and women who were doing that. I'm going to take you to the battalion aid station right outside Fallujah to give your listeners a sense of what it was like. So we are a couple hundred yards from the front lines. The Battle of Fallujah started essentially on after the Blackwater contractors were ambushed, killed, and if you recall, their bodies were dragged through the streets and hung from a bridge. In response to that, on the night of April 4th, 2004, American forces launched a major assault in an attempt to establish control and security over Fallujah. So this is when the Battle of Fallujah began. I arrived at the battalion aid station just a couple days after the initial assault into Fallujah. My battalion was one of two main battalions to lead that charge and be the tip of the spear into Fallujah. I was positioned at the Cloverleaf, which was the aid station a couple of 100 yards outside the city. We would stay there for days on end. We would rotate out after a few days to give some, you know, time for rest, relaxation, and resupplying. And then we would receive directly from the front lines injured Marines who had been injured in the line of duty. And that would typically be gunshot wounds, mortars, rockets. And I'll give you one particular day that was one of the most intense days. We had received a number of casualties, a few Marines with life-threatening gunshot wounds. A couple of Marines had received mortal wounds. One had sustained a gunshot wound to the back of the head that unbelievably didn't kill him. He was still alive when he came in. We had to proceed kind of with all out efforts to try to save him, even though we knew that the chance of survival was extremely dim. But when you're there and there's other Marines around, you want them to see that you're going to go and proceed with all out efforts, no matter what, every time. And so that's what we did. And as we're working on this Marine, we're on the ground, knees are in gravel. It's hot. You're wearing these flak jackets that are pretty heavy. You've got your Kevlar helmet on. It's hard to breathe, sweating profusely. In the background, there may be a whole host of things going on. There may be Cobra attack helicopters flying overhead. There may be tanks rolling through the Cloverleaf because the Cloverleaf was a major artery, a highway that led right into Fallujah. So a lot of combat operations went right through our position there. So tanks amphibious assault vehicles, platoons going in and out of Fallujah. So this chaos of combat is right in the background. Sometimes mortars landing not too far as we're working on Marines or receiving casualties. I describe in the book that whole experience was just wild, almost a surreal experience. There were some days where I kind of looked around and wondered how I got myself here. There were some days when, and I describe it in the book, that I had some serious conversations with God, kind of the why me thing or how me thing, despite my desire to serve my country and really even choosing military life. It was challenging for me to accept the depth of combat trauma that I was seeing and even some of the feelings that I was going through. And by that, I mean really accepting that I could be in harm's way enough to die. You know, I'll just be honest, you know, in the nights when some of those rockets hit close enough, I had to fully accept that I could not make it home just like the guy next to me. I also say that, and I would never imply that I was nearly as much in harm's way as the Marines on the front line, but we were close enough to get hit with rockets, and we were hit on a couple of nights. And when they land close enough to knock you off your feet, you've got to have a conversation with the good Lord. So I did that. I won't really talk about all of those events, but there's a chapter in the book where I made my peace with God, kind of like Lieutenant Dan did in Forrest Gump. And that's a shout out to Gary Sinise, because he was kind enough to support my book.
I noticed that. And Gary Sinise is one of my favorite people for many, 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 many reasons. So yeah. Shout out to Gary Sinise. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the dying thing, because I actually interviewed another member of the armed forces earlier this week, as a matter of fact, who's also written a book. And he says that his name is Benjamin Sledge. And he told me earlier this week that in order to be a successful soldier, you have to be okay with dying. Now, that's not to say that you want to die. And this might be the reason I'm speaking slowly is because I want to make sure I communicate it properly. It's by no means being suicidal. To the contrary, you want to live. But you have to be okay in your mind with the idea of dying. Does that make any sense at all to you?
Yes, it does. It makes, especially for my experience and what I encountered in my journey, it makes a lot of sense. And the insight into that for your listeners is that leading up to the point where I made that peace with my fate, and whether you're spiritual or not, I think most people will come to the same conclusion. When you can release the fact that you don't have control over the situation, and you can understand that there's a higher power guiding your life. For me, of course, that's my faith in God and the good Lord and Jesus. When you can release controls over that steering wheel and know that you have done everything you can to prepare mentally and physically, and that you're going to be okay in one way or another, allowing yourself to give up those reins of control really is freeing. And it allowed me, after I was able to do that, which was an event that happened at night when I was at one of my worst moments of just kind of struggling with the moment and the death and destruction I was seeing. Man, when I was able to let that go off my shoulders, I could go forward and do my job better with more clarity and more confidence, and go forward knowing that I was going to be okay no matter what, in life or death.
Wonderful. Amazing. I want to read from chapter 9 of the book, and I have a question at the end, I promise.
Got it.
Begin quote, "Another Humvee comes tearing down the road and brakes hard to stop right in front of us. A distraught appearing Marine jumps out from the passenger side and yells, 'Help us, I think our sergeant is dead.' From the back of the vehicle, two men grab his shoulders while two others grab his legs, and they all proceed to pull a very lifeless Marine from the Humvee, then place him on a stretcher on the side of the road. He is young and tall, in his 20s, clean shaven with tightly trimmed hair. I kneel next to him, placing the bell of my stethoscope over his heart to look for signs of life, a breath, a pulse, a reactive pupil, but there is nothing." End quote. When you're in a situation like that, Dr. Wilkes, what are you feeling? What's going through your mind?
Yeah, let me try to answer that by, you know, putting myself back there as much as I can. That was a rough day. what I'm seeing and feeling, you know, they all kind of, I would say, go back to in the moment there, I access a file cabinet in my brain. The file cabinet's filled with training, with things that I've learned, with being in the situations to some extent previously, but in a controlled environment, in a hospital, in an emergency room, things like that. But then going back to some of the military training that we had in the field and things like that. And accessing that file card of, okay, this is step 1, 2, and 3. Not allowing my emotions to take over. There's a time for that. There's a time for grieving and sorrow and things like that. But that's one of the things I think about higher level training, especially being in the military, is, you know, you've learned to, you know, operate in an austere environment. And so my primary focus of my energy and my mental and physical capabilities was just going to work and accessing that file on what to do. And I think you will and have probably heard that by talking to other professionals, whether it's on 9/11, firemen, policemen, military, that's what they do. They go to town and they do their job. And that's the beauty, I think, of operating with professionals. So we would go to work and just proceed with all out efforts to save the Marine. And then there certainly was a time beyond that where me and my men would get together, maybe grieve, talk about what went well, what didn't go well, and what we might do differently the next time. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that did, Dr. Wilkes. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. As you look back at your time in Fallujah, Dr. Wilkes, I'm curious if there's a particular memory or event that sticks out for you.
Many.
Yeah. It's many. A broad question.
Yeah, I'm going to give you one that really, despite, you know, the war and emotional events and traumatic events, et cetera, that is part of why I joined the military and what I love about it and always will. And it has to do just with the camaraderie and love it is for me to be an American, to have the freedoms and the life that we do. Not that we're perfect or that America's perfect or the United States military is perfect, but I love being a part of it because we do things a lot differently than, let's say, some of the other, you know, combatants around the world. And I think we can hold our heads high because of that. So I love the tradition of the United States military and what it brings to the table and the things that we've tried to do better over the years. And, you know, you can get politics mixed in it and looking back on different wars, and obviously there's mistakes we've made and things like that. But the people that I worked with were second to none. And so on a particular day, getting back to your question, there's this day at the Cloverleaf and it was a rough day. Some Marines had died, but we're making a lot of progress in the fight in Fallujah. And some of my best friends were the military commanders, the company commanders in the battalions. And I am just finishing treating one of my Marines. There's a little lull. One of the platoons rolled on into the Cloverleaf from Fallujah. And I'm kind of spun up with what's going on that day and a little bit stressed out. And here comes my buddy, Captain Phil Treglia, and he's walking towards me and he's strapped from head to toe with his gear and Kevlar and his M16. He's got grease and dirt on his face. And I look at him and he's walking towards me and he's smiling. He looks excited. He's got a pep in his step and he's just fired up to see me. And we do a high fist grab and kind of chest bump thing. And he asked me how I am. And I ask how he is and you know, how combat operations are going. And it just strikes me, Phil is fired up. He is even maybe excited to be here. And in my head, I'm thinking, how on earth does he look this good and feel this good? And it just strikes me, he's just meant to be here. He was born to do this. And so were many of these guys. And so was I. You know, even though I wouldn't quite put myself in that category, but eventually I would, and I did. But that was just exciting and invigorating to see him and also operate with the rest of the military and specifically my battalion, because I think we were a special group of men that were put together and were meant for the mission that we went on. And to see that history and spirit of what it means to be a United States military member in true form and true life for someone who wasn't from the military, it was very inspiring.
Beautiful. I love that, Dr. Wilkes. Thank you.
Got it.
Just a few questions left. Then you're no longer my prisoner. How's that sound?
Okay. Sounds good.
So when was it that you came back to the States, and how did you readjust to civilian life?
Yeah, we returned in June or July of 2004. And it was, glorious, the return. It was everything that you have seen in a movie for me personally.
Kissing the ground?
Yeah. There was and it's different for everybody. So my experience isn't going to capture everybody. But because, being in a combat zone was unique for me the first time, and it was for a lot of the men, but other members had been on one or two deployments already or more. There was a lot of fanfare at this time in the war too. So when we landed at March Air Force Base in California, there was fire trucks with sirens going off and water fountains and things like that. The stewardesses on the airplane were all dressed up in patriotic, uniforms and things like that. And then when we got back to the base, we marched in to our parade deck in formation. Families are there, a lot of fanfare, loved ones you hadn't seen forever. My wife-to-be was waiting for me, my family, my dad, all those things. So amazing day. And then to go to the other part of your question, transitioning to civilian life was challenging, harder than I thought it would be. A lot of vets will tell you that and describe different experiences. I didn't expect what I encountered because to a large extent, part of my job was preparing the Marines for how to transition, how to take care of yourself, what combat stress is like, what PTSD is like. I gave briefs, talks to the men as we came home on those subjects and how to recognize it and when to seek help and things like that. And the thing I didn't realize is that when you're in a combat zone and living in that environment and exposed to mortars, rockets, et cetera, you're living on a 10 out of 10. Your adrenaline, your sympathetic nervous system, your drive to survive is living at that 10 out of 10. And you don't even know it because that's your fight or flight mechanism. That's what your body does to survive. And turning off that switch, decompressing from that when you come back, it doesn't happen overnight. Your body isn't ready. It hasn't received the memo that you're home and there's no mortars and rockets anymore. So that takes time. And I realized that by listening to my wife to be, and also just watching how I reacted to things. We were in Mexico one night. There's some fireworks went off across the street. Mm-hmm. I jumped out of bed like a caged animal, wondering what was going on. And I was having, a little panic attack. Those kinds of things happened for weeks to months. And then there's some anger and irritability and things like that that I had to go through. And, fortunately, I was able to recognize it. So was my wife, Katie. And we got through it together. Other men had it much worse and, did have PTSD and things like that. So I became much more connected to those situations, how to address them and how to talk to others about them. And fortunately, the United States military, I think, has done a really good job of destigmatizing PTSD and combat stress and things like that. And so when I went on my second deployment a few years later, I was better prepared for how to handle it emotionally and how to transition back to civilian life. And I'm a better doctor for it too, as well, because I've been able to work with vets a lot closer on those kinds of things.
Excellent. Excellent. You introduced it a few moments ago, Dr. Wells. I think I'd like to pull it back in. I'm very curious, how did going to war affect your faith, or did it?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. So yes, I went into it being a man of faith, always have been. With that said, the caveat is, probably didn't come full circle till I was in my 20s. I was raised Catholic, but didn't quite make that connection on how it fit into my life. That happened in my 20s. And so with that said, there's that common saying, there's no atheists in foxholes. And, I get it. I understand what that means and why it's said. But everyone goes through their own journey. And mine was understanding that it's okay to ask God those tough questions, to be angry, to be scared, to be upset, to have doubts in your faith. That's normal. That's documented in the Bible, episodes of that. So there's nothing wrong with those things. And you should go through those things. And then you start developing how you get that back. I talked to people. I talked to our battalion chaplain, amazing guy, Chaplain Wayne Hall, to help get me back to where I needed to be. And then everybody's journey is different. Mine came full circle while I was in Fallujah. And that was where I kind of hit ground zero a little bit. And I talk about it in the book, how I made amends with where I was and my fate. And I went forward stronger from that day forward. But it's a continual journey. And I talk about that in my book a little bit too. I think faith and where how that fits in your life and how it helps you and makes you stronger is a continual journey. And staying in that zone, staying in that journey and allowing it to foster and grow is part of every person's journey with their faith. And it's also a wonderful part of the journey as well. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that did, Dr. Wilkes. Thank you. Yeah. And then the book, once again, Code Red Fallujah, A Doctor's Memoir at War. What was it that prompted you to actually write the book, Dr. Wilkes?
That was a development for my second deployment back to Iraq. That was an unexpected call to go back, although I suspected it would happen eventually. But for me and my wife, you know, it was, you know, emotionally challenging. And the hardest part of deployment is just fighting the time. There is a lot of downtime amidst some of the chaos. So combating that time, passing the time, is something I had thought about going into the deployment. And when I got there and I was immersed in the sights and sounds of Iraq again, I decided to write about my first deployment. I was also realizing at that time that it was a unique moment in history, that there were just a handful of military physicians that close to combat, that the Battle of Fallujah happened to be one of the biggest, largest, and most violent event of the entire 10-year Iraq war. Mm-hmm. So I started writing the book on that second deployment, the bones of it. You know, I wrote it. And then I came home, put it down for quite some time, picked it up, wrote more. And then maybe 5 years after is when I decided, you know, hey, I want to try to do something professional with it. And so I started rewriting, revamping it. And over the next couple of years, it molded into Code Red Fallujah, and I was able to get it published. And it was all in all just a fun and therapeutic journey for me to write and publish the book. And for your listeners, if they want to see pictures and snapshots and even little videos and things like that, you can go to coderedfallujah.com and message me on any social media, and I'm happy to reply.
Brilliant. And where can people get the book?
Anywhere books are sold. So Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Simon & Schuster, Google it, you'll find it.
Excellent. Dr. Donnelly Wilkes, how can people find out about you, sir?
You know, probably the best place is my website, and that's coderedfallujah.com, and then Instagram, Facebook, and those kinds of things. I've got bios and video clips and things like that. And like I said, I'm happy to respond to questions and comments on my social media.
Beautiful. Dr. Wilkes, this was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. Thank you for your service and for everything that you've done and do.
Hey, thanks, Josh. And thank you for what you do. I'm really impressed by people like yourself who are carrying on the tradition of telling stories, especially when it comes to our American history and our military history. So keep up the good work.
That's very kind. I appreciate it. You take care, sir.
All right, Josh. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.